No, the whole extraterrestrial thing is not a viable solution to this.
We need to go through a turning point in the study of this whole domain, away from ideology. We're not here to prove that we're being visited by, you know, aliens from this planet or that star. That may very well be true, but we have not done the basic work.
I have this hunch that this phenomenon is comes from some sort of domain of pure information, and the fact that it can interact with us at all suggests that that we inhabit a domain that's also pure information.
Are we go conditioned here? Yes.
My friend, we are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence, based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
Ooh, all of them answered at the same time. Yeah, I just have to turn down my record level on my recorder. Yeah, I do two recordings.
I'm chewing. If you can hear me chewing, it's probably a bad thing.
Yeah,
I
probably.
I can hear you chewing.
Are you chewing?
Damn it. Son of a bitch. Fine then.
Mr. Cutchin, take that, whatever that is, out of your mouth.
If I had a nickel.
Okay, well, I'll take a drink here too. All right. We have right now, I don't think anybody's listening, but I'm going to post this right away. Oh, there is a listener. Hello, listener. Okay, so that'll build up as time goes. What happened was a couple of weeks ago, I was on with Michael, Josh, and Soraya on Where Did the Road Go? And we got into a very involved discussion about what UFO researchers or even paranormal researchers might be doing to push their luck, create something that might that might have a reaction. And that, I don't know if we talked about it when we were on the show at that time, but that's the first thing, one of the first things that was ever done by Al Bender when they did the calling occupants experiment.
I think a simpler way to put it is be proactive. Like, I think that's
yeah, but you know, the point of the, we can talk about anything. I mean, I just saw a set of tarot cards that were based on Twin Peaks that I'm just about peeing myself over. So we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, I saw those too.
God, they're amazing. I already ordered mine. So,
oh, nice.
Well, Mike hates Twin Peaks and tarot. So good luck getting him to talk about that.
Well, he can make fun of it while we talk about it. But anyway, yeah, proactive.
No, he's being silly. That happens to
super
be
facetious.
Yeah.
Okay. Proactive is probably a good word for it. And the main thing is that I think that people are scared of it. And unfortunately, the kind of people that aren't scared of it might be kind of wacko. So, you know, I think what we're looking for is somebody who are well-grounded yet can do crazy things and entertain more than one, you know, paradigm at once or none at all. And that's a rare combination of traits, I think. I don't even know, you know, I don't really know anybody that has those traits strongly. I don't know. I guess Robert Anton Wilson might have, Aleister Crowley might have, even Jacques Vallée might. I have no idea. But strangely enough, he's the one that pushed it, where I saw this quote with in the interview, and I think we mentioned this on the last show, the interview with Jerome Clark in the 1970s, late 70s, for Fate, I think, for Fate magazine. And he said, I think UFO researchers should get involved with the phenomenon somehow. And Clark was saying, well, doesn't that invite, you know, craziness and mental instability and all kinds of things? And Vallée said, well, yeah, it does. But, you know, we should let that stop us. That was basically his answer. And I think and Clark was horrified. There might not be that widespread horror at this point, but it's still probably, at least among the rank and file, it's probably like, what are you, a bunch of, you know, a bunch of wackos? We need to use science. Science is going to save us. No, it's not. A combination of science and other things are going to save us. That's what I think, anyway.
Yeah. I have the excerpt from that magazine, because I wrote an article under my nom de plume back in the day in the 90s, Usenet, that era.
Yeah.
I called it Attempted Manipulation of UFO Manifestations. Because that's what Vallée called it. He was talking to Jerry Clark, and Clark said, well, Vallée says, I think that's exactly what we have to do with UFOs. We have to do something that will cause them to react. And I don't mean building landing strips in the desert and waiting out there to welcome the Space Brothers. And Clark says, but what do you mean? Huh. And Vallée says, I hesitate to be too specific. I'm speaking, as I'm sure you understand, of the attempted manipulation of UFO manifestations. And later in that same interview, he says, Vallée says, there are certainly occult groups that claim they can invoke or evoke beings that do some of the things that UFO entities do. I've looked, I've contacted a number of those groups.
And I was
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was actually going to make that point. I mean, we may be talking about UFOs, but in a sense, if what people who practice magic and the occult are contacting may be the same entities, aren't they just basically doing that? It's just under a different guise.
Certainly possible.
Yeah. Yeah, they could be. Well, the point is here that one of the points is that there are many ways to. Maybe that's not the tack I want. The tack is, the thing is so intimately connected with us and what we think and how we think, and affected by how we think, at least that's what I believe at the moment, that if we change our way we look at it and way we think of it as not an external thing, or as but more as something that can be communicated with or part of us or whatever you want to call it, that you know, that simple change of, you know, changing your station or your tuning of your brain might be whatever the thing is, you know, might be more on its wavelength. And I do think there's an external thing, a thing that's not us, that's there. And people have been calling it different things for hundreds of years, and magicians call it one thing, and esoteric practitioners of religions call it another thing, and, you know, and I think you guys agree with me on that. But
yes,
no,
yeah,
go ahead.
Absolutely,
absolutely. And I quite like the idea of, like, the and I'm not, this is not original to me, but, like, I quite like the idea of the oceanographer or the marine biologist studying the shark. Like, you can study shark attacks all you want to, but at some point you need to get in a cage and you need to chum the waters. And I think that is something that we're all sort of alluding to, regardless of what you want to call it. I think that there is an obligation on the part of the vanguard of ufology to try to engage with these things. Not saying that I'm that person, but because I'm still terrified enough. But there are people who are dedicated enough to want to get into the shark cage.
Yeah, well, I think they should get in the shark cage, and, you know, it's, I think for a decent result, you cannot be in a cage, and that's the probably disheartening. Not disheartening. That's probably the brave soul part. Because
maybe,
go ahead.
Maybe you should be within
a sense. You're self bait, right?
Yeah, maybe you should be within a circle. if not a cage.
Maybe something like that. I have, over the years, I have talked to people who have done this kind of thing. And some of them have come very close to disconnecting from our reality and not having an easy time of it. Sure. That's the dangerous part.
Sure.
Because they start... In fact, somebody described it to me once, and it sounded exactly like the Aleister Crowley Lamb meditation, where he told me that it seems like I'm looking at me or at our reality from the eyes of something that isn't us, and it really freaked him out.
Mm-hmm.
It took him a few months to get to that point, but you know, it's, you know, how do you shut that off after it's already, you know? So that's the part. And eventually he was fine. I mean, he just, you know, he got involved with things in his life and on this part of existence, or even whatever you want to call it, and he was basically fine. But you know, I've seen that more than once, where people get kind of wonky when they try to do some of this stuff. So, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for borrowing from occult practice. There's also a lot to be said about knowing human psychology and your psychology, really. And and also keeping as much as possible, you know, some kind of weird ass Zen detachment from it as it's happening. I don't know if that'll screw it up, though, you know. Can you be subjective and objective at the same time? Do you want to be objective, or do you want to be completely subjective and really get close to, or probably drive yourself nuts? That's kind of how I see it.
Well, Soraya, as someone who has shark bait written all over him, would you like to respond?
I have no idea what you're talking about, Josh.
you lather up with fish heads before you get in the water. I mean,
we'll just call him the human chum. So yeah. Chumming for aliens.
What I was going to say is I think the phenomena and really reality itself is just kind of a feedback mechanism. And I think that whether or not there's something out there is really hard to tell, because so much of it comes from us. And it could be there's something there and it's just taking its form from us. But it seems like, you know, when you look at like synchronicities and things like that, right down, you know, the more esoteric you get, the more obvious the feedback loop is. But I think just with everyday life, there's a feedback loop that people just don't notice.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the feedback is being checked and rechecked by your subconscious before it gets to your conscious, and it's saying, hey, right, everything's okay. The minute something's not okay, it starts painting wonderful pictures so that everything is generally okay, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. But even I think just the way that reality forms around us becomes kind of a feedback loop.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think too. Go ahead.
Now, I was going to say, I mean, I've told this story a bunch of times, so I won't go into it again. But my major sighting experience in my life, I essentially summoned or asked to see something in the sky. And my girlfriend was with me, so this wasn't a subjective experience. She's the one that saw the two lights that started moving around and then shot across the sky. After, you know, this was minutes after me looking up at the stars on the beach and mentally saying, okay, if you're out there, show yourselves. So that's what caused me to become so fixated on this particular aspect of this subject. And that's why I wrote that piece about Valet and the attempted manipulation of these things. That said, I'm deeply interested in trying to do it again. But as I mentioned to you guys before, when I find myself out in the middle of the woods alone on a dark night, suddenly I think maybe that's not such a great idea anymore. And Greg, you mentioned the fear aspect, and you know, there's something really terrifying about asking to see something and then having something literally show up. So
yeah. Well, so see, the fear would
maybe
come
with some
from
other people. I'm sorry, go ahead. I was just going to say that maybe with, you know, if this was done in more of a group setting, it might be a little less terrifying than going it alone.
Yeah. I mean, look at Whitley Strieber. So,
right.
Yeah, well, I guess it takes a really singular type of person to be able to just go and go it alone. People have done it. They can do it. I think part of it might be that, not that, I guess the detachments thing, but you said, you know, Michael, right? You said that you thought of something and then it happened. Maybe if you don't think that an external thing is reacting to you and more like it's something that was there anyway, and you just retuned yourself and it just, it, you know, the reality adjusted to your retuning. You know, it, anyway, just, you know, giving it some sort of a model that doesn't freak you out, you know what I mean, as you're doing it.
Yeah.
Might be part of it.
I mean, see, with me, you know, I was practicing magic, but I was also studying UFOs and had no idea they were connected in any way until I read something by Strieber and I started going, wait a minute, I've had all these experiences, but there were no UFOs involved.
Right, right.
And I've always been the type of person to dive right in, like without using necessarily circles and things like that, because I didn't necessarily believe anything was going to happen. So I figured I wanted to give it its best shot at happening.
Right, right. Exactly. Yeah, and then what does happen, you know, that's like we were saying before, that's where the detachment comes in, and you can sit there hopefully and say, well, that's fascinating or interesting, and not go, ah, you know, because I think if you do that, it might shut it off or turn it into something that really is scary. Because absolutely, at that point, I think there's a feedback going, a very strong, yes, quick subconscious feedback.
I would agree with that completely.
Yeah. It's when you get the realization, when you get the confirmation, to use another Strieber word, when you get the confirmation that this stuff is real, when you first do a magical ritual and either something manifests or something happens afterward that is just an absolute
unequivocal
confirmation that something you may have thought may have been real. So then you realize it's real. That's a big life changer. That's sort of an initiatory moment, I think, you know, and
it's a tiny chapel perilous.
Yes, exactly. I think you're right. I think you have to try to keep a kind of emotional and intellectual distance, but honestly, it's difficult sometimes. I guess depending upon what's actually happening, when those lights started doing crazy things in the sky, I haven't been the same. I've spent all of my life since then trying to figure out how my consciousness is connected to these things.
Yeah.
And Greg, you brought up when we were talking the last time, the Philip experiment. And I think that's a really fascinating lens to look at this idea through.
Yes. Yeah, if people don't know, if you didn't hear the other show or whatever, the Conjuring Up Philip is a book from 1978 or something like that. I got the book right here. Wait. Right on top of my copy of The Magical Revival by Kenneth Grant. Anyway, I've been reading up on this a bit. Anyway, 1976. In the mid-1970s, a group in Toronto, I believe it was, a paranormal group, said, let's try an experiment. Let us make up someone, a completely fictional character, but let us be absolutely specific about what he looks like. So they drew a picture of him. They said he lived in, you know, 1720 something. His name was Philip something or other. Here it is. I opened the book trying to look for the thing, for the description, and the page fell open to the one I needed. Philip was an aristocratic Englishman living in the middle 1600s at the time of Oliver Cromwell. He had been a supporter of the king and was a Catholic. He was married to a beautiful but cold and frigid wife, Dorothea, the daughter of a neighboring nobleman. One day, when out riding on the boundaries of his estates, he came upon a gypsy encampment and blah, 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 blah. So this was a complete invention by this group. And so after they had this all firmly fixed in their minds, they started doing seances to contact Philip. And of course, you know, Philip came out, and you know, if you're a, what's the word? If you're a a materialistic skeptic, you would say, well, of course that's what happened because they all primed themselves and it was, you know, something that they expected anyway, and that's what was happening. They were deluding themselves, which is fine. It could be true. What isn't that doesn't fit in with that is weird stuff started happening, like poltergeist phenomena, tables moving, stuff happening in people's houses. They demonstrated this in a TV studio. So apparently, they were able to conjure something up that they had completely made up, and it started responding mm-hmm. to them as a, you know, as a, like a simulacra, or not a simulacra, what's the word, a golem or something like that, but something that they create, a tulpa. They basically,
tulpa, yes.
Yeah, they basically mm-hmm. created a tulpa, not an yeah. incarnate tulpa that walked around and did things, but mm-hmm. it had apparently physical effects. And so this is, vitally interesting to me. Mm-hmm. And does that mean that they made something up so that, you know, it, you know, they created it and it called into some kind of psychic existence, or did it exist before, or was it some sort of energy that they formed into something? Was there something somebody really called Philip from then that they somehow subconsciously picked up on? Who knows? All these questions mm-hmm. come up to the fore when you read this book and consider the circumstances that they created.
And you can find
the
right. Yeah, yes, Paul. You can find video of one of the seances they did on TV.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. You see the table like moving across
studio.
The room towards yeah. the audience through the studio towards yeah. the audience. Yeah, it's really amazing, and what
I guess could be faked or whatever. But the thing is, it happens so many times. See, there's a point at which I get to, you know, it's like, oh, it's fake. It's like, why don't we just consider it's not for a little bit and see what happened?
Uh-huh.
You know, that's my attitude. It might have been fake, but it's more interesting to me to think that, what if this really was happening, and how can it be reproduced? Because it has been reproduced in various ways throughout the centuries.
Yeah. The tulpa concept, I think it was Alexandra David Neal that first talked about that.
Yeah, magic and mystery in Tibet.
In her book, yeah, about her travels in Tibet. And, you know, she starts saying her companions, she didn't tell anybody she was working on this form of magic. And other people started seeing the tulpa that she was creating. I have another very brief story. When I was a kid, I'm kind of outing myself, if any of my friends from grade school are out there and they hear this.
Out yourself.
I created a ghost called Boogman. Boogman. I guess it was like a derivative of the boogeyman or something.
It sounds like a 90s stoner comic. The Boogman.
It does. Yeah, the Boogman. But I came up with this ghost, and I started telling everybody about this ghost, and he was a friend of mine, and he did things, and sure enough, people started talking about encountering this ghost, friends of mine. They were not joking. I mean, these are kids. I was probably about 8, 9 years old or something when I was doing this. And recently, the reason why this came to mind is I found a postcard from a kid named Paul who moved away from Baltimore. And he sent me a postcard. Hey, I really like my new school, blah, 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 blah. He's like, have you seen Boogman anymore? That's how years after this, when these kids nice. Started getting older, they were still talking about it. And I couldn't fess up to the fact that I had started making this thing up because I felt bad. Like they might be mad at me for, you know, jerking their chains for so long. But the fact that they started talking about their own encounters with this thing really freaked me out. And to this day, I was a kid. I had no idea what a tulpa was. I had no idea what any of this stuff was. I just thought it was fun to talk about a friendly ghost that was my friend, you know, that hung around me and did things. But then when other people started saying, oh yeah, this thing moved in my room and it had to be Boogman, I thought, oh my God, what have I done? So I feel like I have some firsthand experience with this too, which is another, it makes me feel terrible in a way, but I also wonder, did we give, you know, our combined thinking about this ghost, did we generate something like the Philip, you know, like entity? Yeah.
Well, and the fact that it was sort of an off the cuff thing and that you put some intention behind it, but didn't like stress and dwell over it, probably says something about why it manifested. I mean, I'm making some assumptions about the level of thought that you put into it, but you didn't like create a giant Boogman mythos or anything.
Right, right. I was just goofing around, and if something weird would happen, like something would fall over, I would say, oh, that's him. So maybe... Go ahead, Greg. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think you were probably opening the door a bit and tuning the tuner a little bit better every time you did that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you know, a conventional person would say, you're giving it strength. And it's like, you know what? That is a bad road to go down.
Yeah.
My first reaction would be, and I just put a comment up on the Writing Mysterioso Facebook page. This show is research too. Just sitting talking to you guys and throwing these ideas around is research too.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
But thinking of your model every time and the non-specific nature of your model might be a good way to go about it. Instead of saying I'm giving it power, you're just saying I'm allowing something to happen to see what happens, instead of being scared of this thing that might, because your expectations are really going to steer where this thing goes. So it's a really weird thing, like I said earlier, to have no expectation or very little.
No. And then, now, what? Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, my comment about like a lack of a robust mythos is in direct conflict with the whole Philip experiment, but maybe that's somehow correlated with how many people are involved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the more people involved in something like this, the more bandwidth there is for a more in-depth sort of fabrication.
Yeah, I kind of fight that. I'm kind of like, well, you know, it's because it sounds very, what's the word? It sounds too literal for me, but it seems that in the past that idea has worked, has helped these things work a little bit better by keeping them one, more on an even keel, because there's a lot of people there, so you've got some strength there. And two, maybe there is strength in numbers.
You look at imaginary friends versus Slenderman, right? Friends have a mythos created by one person, and it's usually pretty small, versus something like Slenderman. That's Slenderman. Hello, my name is John Slenderman.
Yes, Spiderman. Slenderman.
Spiderman. Slenderman, which is sort of has taken on sort of a more global toehold in terms of culture.
Yeah. I guess we should also consider the idea, chaos magicians have had the idea of a servitor for some time as well. And I think that's where the popular idea of the way tulpas are, you hear people talking about, oh, I'm forming a tulpa out of, My Little Pony or something. And, the whole concept has become kind of cheesed out over time. But the idea of thought forms and tulpas and servitors, I think chaos magic really put the spin on it, that you fuel these things and you send them out to do your bidding, or they're essentially a means to an end.
Yeah.
And that they also talk about having to take it apart, or it can go feral. And so that, I think that those ideas also sort of form the popular conception of the stuff that we're talking about as well. I didn't want to leave out, I think that was a very big development in this sort of thinking, was when chaos magic pushed that concept of servitors very, very hard.
Yeah. Good point. Yeah. It's also designed to appeal to the, when do I get to smite people?
Right.
Which I think is like the vast majority of, a very good majority of people that get into Western occultism, and specifically stuff like the OTO and chaos magic, is they're attracted by it because they think that it's going to give them a one up on people. And that has nothing to do with what the hell's going on there. What it is you're already, this is why Israel Regardi said, before you do any of this, go through a heavy set of psychotherapy so you realize what your motivations are. Because if your motivations are to go out and smite, then there's something wrong with you. You think you've got the superhero view of the comic book view of occultism, and to my mind, that has nothing to do with it. I think when they say something like servitor, it might be a convention to talk about something in a way that people might understand, if that makes any sense.
You know, Crowley would always make the comment that it didn't matter why people got involved in magical practice to begin with. Like, even if they wanted to become a magician just so they could smite people or kill people with magic, because by the time, because by the time they got to the point where they could actually do that, they would have enlightened themselves enough to know not to do that.
Right. Exactly. I mean, why? What the hell are you doing here if you had to go do that? And another thing is, what the hell are you doing here if you had to go do that? And then you had to tell me. You know, that there's an ego thing going on there, is there not? Which shouldn't be there if you're getting into this for the right reasons or whatever, for productive reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, there's always going to be some ego involved. I mean, it's how we perceive the universe.
Of course, of course. But it's, there's balance.
Sorry, go ahead. I was going to say, this is a UFO show where we're talking about magic.
It's not a UFO show. It's a show about anything that my guests and I want to talk about. It always
and because
has
honestly, to. They're very connected, too, as well, I think. I mean, I don't think you can take one out of the other. I think they're just different ways of looking at a similar phenomena.
Right, right.
I absolutely agree. Yeah.
Greg, do you remember from the early days when we were strapping young lads on the internet, the guy with our dial-up modems?
Yeah.
Do you remember the internet personality known as Blue Resonant Human?
Yes, I do.
Brother Blue?
Yes.
He deserves a lot more credit.
Yes, he does. I went to his house once.
You did. Oh, my God.
But he was not home.
Oh.
What's funny is he told me to come to his house when he lived in San Diego. I went to San Diego to visit him. I went to his house, and his daughter or somebody answered. I guess he had a family. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, he's not here right now. And I can't remember what his name was. But, yes, I remember that guy. I used to talk to him on the phone for hours.
Devin.
Yeah.
I think his name was Devin.
I think you're right.
Yeah. He was the first, really, I think, to put a lot of the pieces together.
Right.
And he did so in a very funny way. I encourage anybody listening now, go look the guy, go look his stuff up. It's still, I think it's archived at the Gray Lodge or something.
Yeah, it's still on. If you look up Blue Resonant Human or Brother Blue, you can find his stuff. Yeah, and I got this very strong feeling from him, or maybe he told me that he was involved at least either with the military or as a military contractor. And I think he was, because he lived near Miramar Air Station for a while, and that's where I went to his house. I think in his driveway there was a sign on the door that said CIA parking only.
he really tweaked ufologists too. I mean, he didn't suffer the ETH nuts and bolts hardcore proponents gladly at all.
No.
He was a very funny guy, and his work was so ahead of its time. The stuff we're talking about now,
right?
He was talking about in 1994.
Yeah, thanks so much for bringing that up.
You're welcome. I love running into people that know his stuff because they realize how big this guy was.
Yeah, I didn't even realize. I just thought it was him and I talking and a couple other people I knew that knew who he was, and that was about it. And then somehow I got his phone number, and I talked to him for quite a bit. I just never met him.
Uh-huh.
I came close.
I never met him either. Yeah, we communicated a bit because we both had an interest in the overlap of magic and UFOs and everything, but he was just so far ahead of the curve. And
yeah, Steve just put something up on him. Thanks, Steve.
Oh, cool. Yeah, he was the first to really pushed the Lamb statement and Kenneth Grant and all that stuff. And he was really putting it out there. I think it was I can't remember the name of the news group, Alt Alien something or other.
Yeah.
And man, so this stuff, it's funny. It sort of flourished and then it went underground and it really seems to be bubbling up to the surface again.
I'm glad.
Yeah,
I'm really glad. I just saw something.
I just got schooled.
Yeah. I just saw something a couple days.
I wasn't aware of any of this, yeah.
Really? I just saw something a couple days ago, and somebody said, I'm beginning to really think that a lot of this stuff comes from us and not from the UFOs. Like, yes! Yeah. This is starting, you know, and somebody did a, you know, there was a blog post on it by someone who I can't remember now, but, you know, I read it and I go, God damn it, I said that 2 years ago. And then, you know, not me, you know, 50 other people said it 50 years ago. So, but that's not the point. The point is that this kind of stuff is spreading. And I think that's I don't know if it'll take over all of paranormal research. I really don't. I kind of hope it doesn't. I just hope it gets really popular and people that know what they're doing work with it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Stephanie asked, anyone on the panel know about Bright Garlic's work on contacting aliens? No, I do not.
I don't either, no.
No.
You guys?
Well, I'm going to have Stephanie come on then. No. Well, if you can put a link up there, Steph, on the Radio Mysterioso Facebook page, that'd be great. And, was that Josh? You said you were schooled?
Yeah, I wasn't aware of bright blue resonant. Resonant
human, yeah. Brother Blue.
Yeah, Brother Blue. Yeah, that is a gold mine of information. It's just like, you know, I'm glad Michael brought it up because I hadn't thought of him in years. And this is probably a good time to bring him back up again. I don't even know where he is. You know, I'd like to find out where he is. He kind of disappeared off the map and then, you know, his phone number wasn't good anymore. And I don't know what. Oh, I know what happened. You know who introduced me to him was Richard Metzger from Disinfo.
Oh,
he said,
yeah,
you guys would get along real well. And we started talking. And I think that he got divorced and he moved. He was like in a beach house in Pacific Beach in San Diego for a while. And I talked to him a couple times there and then he kind of disappeared off the map.
I think he decided to give up this stuff. That's the impression I got. And I read something he wrote that talked about taking large amounts of methamphetamine and off in the woods and seeing soldiers coming through the woods. It was a little sad and disturbing. And if it was him, this could have been someone else using his nom de plume, I guess. But it was really disturbing. It made me worry that because when he stopped, he sent me a little bit of an enigmatic email when I tried to get in touch with him once, and it made me feel like he either got scared off or something happened and he was just done with this whole subject.
A Bender exit, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
I was just going to say you were talking earlier about things that happen when you start to lose your mooring when you're playing with the occult, and as we know that happens in Fortiana and ufology quite often too.
Yeah, it happens, and smart people that want to keep their sanity leave it and go somewhere else and quit, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. maybe they quit and come back later. Crazy people keep sending out crazier and crazier emails and turning into people somebody that nobody wants to be around anymore, unfortunately, and unfortunately for them, because they go off the rails, and that's mm-hmm. too bad. Which is why, you know, what Valet said about it. Yeah, some people, there's a danger there, but mm-hmm. a lot of us know what that danger might be, and maybe we go on ahead in spite of it. Mm-hmm. This is just one way of looking at a lot of this stuff, and I just think it's underrepresented and it's exciting to me, which is why mm-hmm. I wanted to have you guys on.
Yeah, I've talked to other people and I've asked, are these kinds of experiments going on? Are people trying to manifest UFOs or lights or beings? And I've been told that yes, it is happening. It's just kept pretty quiet.
It should be.
And that's unfortunate. Yeah, it's also unfortunate a little bit though, because if we're doing this, if it's kept quiet and then they publish their results, that's great.
Yes.
But if it's, you know, if it's just hidden knowledge for hidden knowledge's sake, I think that's unfortunate. Yeah.
That's what I've been whining about for a little while. It's like people should do these things quietly mm-hmm. in small groups mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. tell everybody what they did, whether it was successful or not, why they think it was successful or not. They don't even have to give their names. It probably is better if they don't. And share that information. You didn't used to be able to do that so easily. Now it's easy as, you know, easy as having a, you know, everybody has an internet connection, at least in this country. It's not everybody, but most people. It's so easy to communicate these findings right now. You just have to put the effort forward and be organized about it, which is, you know, that's the hard, well, the hard part is doing it in the first place. But, you know, getting to the point where you say, here is my research. I almost went nuts. Or we almost went nuts, or one of our members went off into the ether and we don't know where they went, but this is what we found out. And push that out into, you know, onto a, you know, maybe an anonymous website that somebody can start and say, look, this is what we found, try it, or you try whatever you're trying, and we'll see what results people are getting. Because if you're quiet about it, it's not going to help anyone. And the flip side of that is, I think a lot of this stuff might be so individualized that it might not be useful to other people. But the thing is, in describing what happened, you get another little piece of the puzzle, or, you know, a section of the painting, or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
So
let's do it.
Well, come on. Isn't that what Greer is doing with his, ventures out in the deserts with people?
Of course it is. But his ego is so overblown and ridiculous that it completely ruins it.
Yeah, I've also heard of people who've been on those trips, and he's pointing out an airplane and saying it's anomalous.
Yeah.
So there's some credulity there that with I think him and with the people who are paying to be there with him as well.
I've been on
as well.
Yeah, I've been on a couple things, not with Greer, but with, you know, Skywatch things, or people trying to call things down. And yeah, they see satellites and airplanes and they get all excited. And I go, no, that's an airplane. How can you be so sure? I say, it's got a red light on the left, on the left side, a green light on the right side for the direction it's going, and a red flashing light in the back. That's a plane. Mm-hmm. And they get pissed off at me. But then I don't feel smug. I'm just like, I don't want to, you know, see another airplane and get everybody. But then I feel like, am I being so know-it-all and smug that I'm screwing it up for something that might actually happen? And is it, you know, does it come down to what's the word? To, like we were talking in the beginning, Soraya mentioned, does it come down to your personal, you know, formation of reality as it's happening?
Well, and I have the completely unvalidated suspicion that there probably are a couple of Greer encounters that have involved something genuinely anomalous.
Oh, probably.
But I feel like they're outliers that probably tend to reinforce the continuing narrative that he actually can do something. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's
beginner's luck.
Exactly. Yeah. He's asking people for money. He's heavily invested in it monetarily and egotistically. And that, to me, that makes it virtually useless. Well, then I have a huge bias against Greer anyway, but I think in general, ego things have to be kept out of it, because I think that introduces a bunch of noise.
Yeah, I agree.
Or at least kept out of it as much as possible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You can't keep it. Go ahead.
Isn't there a ranch somewhere in the Northwest where people gather to see these things and use those goggles. My mind is blanking.
Night vision.
Night vision goggles.
The FLIR forward-looking infrared goggles. Those
something like that. James Galiland, I guess his name is.
That sounds right. Yep, I think that's it. Yeah, I've seen some fairly impressive footage that they've taped. My question though is that do we want to make lights move around in the sky? Is that what we want to see, or do we want to do something a little more personal?
Yes,
more along the lines of both. Trying to get, you know, like a small group in a, you know, either in the woods or even indoors somewhere, trying to manifest something.
Or over the internet, you know, just do it over Skype. You can do it over Skype, I bet, a little bit in some way. You know, do a Skype seance.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we can do that now. It doesn't, the distance, I don't think, matters at all.
No. Maybe we need to look at spiritualism too as a model.
Yeah.
An obvious model.
Uh-huh.
Spiritualism, magic. But then are we really, I would say you guys probably agree that no matter what we would contact, that it's a manifestation of that other that underlies all this stuff. Or maybe yes. Maybe I'm just making a really big leap.
You would hope
here.
It is.
Yeah.
No, you would hope that that's what you were contacting, that's what was going on, but the thing is that I don't really know how you could test it. You know, it gets to the point of, you know, when you get to the, well, for anything really, but especially with this weird stuff, you know, where does physical actual reality end and what your consciousness formed it into begin? And I think that's that boundary is constantly moving back and forth. In fact, the boundary may be pushing physicality off the map at this point for me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why I said I think reality in general is a feedback loop. I mean, we get what we give from it. And I don't think there's any, I don't know if there's any kind of empirical reality. I think there's stuff we share when we're sharing experiences, but our own reality may be very different from one another.
Right. It's a, yeah, it's a reality is an agreement. And,
yeah.
You know, and at least daily reality. I mean, if you're a fundamentalist materialist type skeptic, you would say, well, you know, physical science has shown us that you can have something that's you can say whatever you want about it, but the experimental evidence shows it the same every time. But how far does that experimental evidence go as far as being an agreement of reality?
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's just a very robust agreement of reality to the point where, you know, it's you've got everybody agreeing on it, so it's very robust, whereas you only have two people agreeing on, you know, if Stephen Greer called aliens down from space, you know. So that's very neat. You know,
thinking of fiction, it's like the Star Wars universe versus the Last Starfighter universe. You know, the Star Wars universe has become this giant, it's metastasized into this giant like multimedia thing, whereas the Last Starfighter is a very self-contained, you know, one or two, you know, in this metaphor, one or two person sort of reality.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, I did zero preparation for this. I just wanted to rant and help you guys, have you guys rant along with me. So that's what we're doing.
You're an enabler. That's your role today.
Yes. Yeah, they used to, you know, people used to ask, you know, what do you think you're, you know, are you a ufologist? No, God damn it, don't call me that. You know, well, what are you doing? I said, I think I'm cheerleading. Or, you know, maybe so, enabling.
So let me turn the tables here.
Please do.
As sort of a challenge to you, because I know that you think this is sort of the direction everything should take, and I definitely empathize and sympathize with that. But what else? Like if for some reason this isn't going to be if for some reason this isn't the banner to be taken up moving forward into the next century, like where does ufology go from here? If not this.
Many pronged. I think question. That's one of them. Well, anybody have a stink they want to make about that?
Yeah, I'll take a stab at it.
Yeah.
I think ufology has reached a point where it needs this kind of experimentation or it's not going to go anywhere. Pending the landing that's caught on 300 cell phones in the middle of Times Square crap idea, which is not going to happen.
Oh, no.
This intelligence, whatever it is playing with us, dragging us somewhere. And I think the only way we're ever going to move the ball ahead is to somehow learn how to interrogate it, to interact with it, to have a conversation with it. Otherwise, it's just going to keep stringing us along. Maybe doesn't want to talk to us. Maybe it's a failed concept from the beginning. But with you know, you look at Strieber's experiences and the feedback that he gets, if we look at that as genuine and valid, is it his where he's having breakthroughs. I'm using all of his book titles tonight. where we have breakthroughs is where we attempt communication with it, where he would go sit out in the by the rocks on his property and try to commune with it, with this stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's where we see where it starts to talk back a little bit.
Yeah. The other point in that, go ahead.
I was going to say, but there's still a language barrier.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think that the UFOs as an art project thing is very important.
That's a beautiful metaphor. Yeah, but I read that in your book, and it stuck in my head. It was like a light bulb going off. Like, that's beautiful.
It's a great idea, and it's emblematic of the sort of thinking that we need. You know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's being presented to us as an art piece, whereby you can't. What art does, or even poetry does, is try to communicate something that cannot be communicated by language. What are UFOs doing? They're trying to communicate something, I think, maybe, that cannot be communicated by language, even though maybe 90 or 95% of that is that that message is coming from us or our interpretation of whatever.
Or maybe they're just a weird glitch in reality.
Yeah, well, that might be too. And you've.
That would be a bummer, though.
Yeah, it is.
It would, but.
Well, the other thing that Valet said in that little piece, which was information rich, was what would be interesting would be to feed something into the system and see how it is fed back to you to gain a clue as to what's going on after that message leaves you and before it comes back. What happens to the information when it's sent out and before you receive it again somehow? That's a tough one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, maybe that's something that somebody ought to ask him. Do you have any ideas along these lines? Sending out the message. What? How the hell do you send out a message to the phenomenon? You know, my first idea is like, well, you send out a set of very strong beliefs about it that don't make any sense in light of what most people think, and then see if people start having that kind of experience somewhere or it changes something. But you really have to throw a huge wrench in there, I think, for anything to.
But yeah. In a sense, isn't that what you see with like the Slender Man sightings?
Yeah.
We've created something, sent it out there into the general public, and then suddenly people are like, no, I've actually seen this thing.
Yeah, well, that gets to the point where, you know, I think there's a there's a disturbance in reality, and it's not what everybody expects, and so that whatever you've heard that doesn't quite fit in might be the model that you're shoving it through, the cookie cutter or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or maybe you're going out there looking for it, and that comes to you, and as soon as it comes to you in any form, you go, okay, that's what it is, because that's what you were looking for.
One place I've heard of people doing something similar is, and it was a while back, I don't know if they continued it, and I can't remember the name of the people involved, but they were going into the DMT space.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were trying to communicate something to the entities mathematically, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
It was a really interesting project, but it's very similar to what you're talking about. And it was an attempt to quantify a message sent and how it returned or if other people picked it up. I wish I could remember the details. Maybe somebody listening knows about that project. But that's the closest I think I've ever heard is going into that space with those entities and trying to bounce something off of them and seeing how it comes back. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. And I think altered states play a large part in how we communicate with these things.
Mm-hmm.
Or
I would agree.
Mm-hmm. Or we tune to a different frequency, or maybe clear out the noise of this reality and replace it with some other one. I mean, that's a really fascinating thing. You know, our group is going to go do DMT or acid or whatever with the specific idea in mind, if we don't do too much and lose our egos, to change the conversation somehow. That would be an interesting project too, but you can't go out and tell people, everybody take acid. I mean, it has to be a bunch of, you know, grown-up people that say, look, this is the thing that we did. Yeah. And if you want to do it, we have no, you know, you don't even know who we are. So it's just a story we wrote. Well,
and I would posit that similar things have happened in a much less formal and much less public way, that even if you were to tell everybody about them, they'd be like, oh, well, they were all taking acid.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you know
that's
what?
That's always the problem. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't care. I really don't care if somebody. I don't care if somebody says, "Well, they were all doing acid. We've got work to do."
Mm-hmm. But I mean, Greg Bishop, the UFO buff who has been looking into this, doesn't care. But John Q. Public, for whatever freaking reason, does care. You know, unfortunately.
Screw them.
Unfortunately.
Screw them.
Exactly.
I'm tired of worrying about what the non-mutants think about our sort of research, you know.
Maybe it's because I'm still wet behind the ears, comparatively speaking. Like, I still would like to see some other people like get on board and be like, yeah, this does have something to do with reality and something to do with the way that we perceive reality on an individual basis. And I would like to see a public consensus saying, you know what, altered states have something to do with this. I know it's not going to happen, but I'm still just green enough in this to make sure to really want that to happen.
Yeah. My model
good luck
is,
with that, Trash. Yeah.
My model is when a group of scientists or anybody in a intellectual or whatever pursuit is pursuing that thing, I would almost guarantee you they can't explain it to almost anyone. However, if they have a decent result, they get to the point where they can get into a format where most people, or at least some people, can understand what they're talking about and maybe maybe replicate it. And if it's really good, it gets dumbed down to the point where most people can understand it because it becomes revolutionary and everybody goes, oh, this is a new way of looking at things and I can experience it for myself. That's how I see it going if it's successful at some point. And it may be where somebody has to do something where they get a completely individualized view of what it is and they can't really agree with everybody else about it. But the reality is confirmed to them. The reality of something that is not them, that is, you know, communicating with them, is confirmed individually to them, if you know what
I mean. Right. Yeah, and we've been down this road before. That's especially with psychedelic research in the 50s, 60s, 70s. People were doing parapsychological research involving psychedelics and entheogens. It was done. It was science. And with the new sort of medicalization of entheogens, maybe we could get that back again. Because when I interview researchers, the people who are doing, you know, state government institutional sponsored psychedelic research today, when you talk to them behind the scenes or off the record, they would love to see some experiments with psi phenomena done while people are in, is because they see the manifestations happen in the lab when they're doing it, but they can't talk about it.
Yeah.
Because if psychedelics were the third rail, parapsychology mixed with psychedelics is off the playing, is, you know, completely impossible to consider. Right. And that's really unfortunate because we've been there before. We've done really interesting provocative research using psychedelics, using altered states and doing controlled parapsychological testing. So we can get back to it. I really hope we can.
I think it'll get there. I think people will be, you know, people are with the way things are right now, I think people trust themselves and their experience or whatever they believe more than they trust somebody telling them what is real, which is good in some ways.
Yep.
It's good for this kind of research.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're smart enough and what's the word? If they stick to their guns and follow, you know, stay the course, I think some amazing things can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not to say none of us here aren't doing some weird version of this at some point now. So
I am right now, man.
No, I mean,
and when you,
it's go ahead, Sarah. Go, Soraya.
Oh, and when you talk about the DMT research, obviously Strassman, you know, was doing that and discovering the same stuff we're talking about, that, hey, right, this seems to be connected into other stuff and there seems to be an intelligence here.
Yeah. And he went all new agey. What does that tell you?
Yeah.
It tells me that what he was told was real was not necessarily true. And he knew from personal experience, because, you know, he dipped into the stuff. He had to have. And all of this together made him think, oh, well, I guess I don't really care what anybody else thinks, because I would really like to know what's going on. That's a true, you know, explorer and scientist. They really want to know what's going on and find out what's going on. And they don't care what their peers think, mm-hmm, you know? So, you know, and the peers that are interested will come to them quietly and say what's going on. And the other ones that are don't care about what other people think either, they'll come and help them out. So I think it just keeps going. I would, you know, at some point I'd like to interview Strassman and say, you know, what's gone on? How much further have you taken it? What else has happened? You know? And we'll see, because he went very new agey. If that's what some people would call it. I just think he had his experience, and I hate the word consciousness, but he had his, you know, what he thought was real opened up quite a bit, mm-hmm, or could be real.
Well, he also moved away from the sort of Eastern view of things that he had, where he would, you know, was thinking, oh, DMT gets you closer to whatever, you know, Eastern mystics are trying to get closer to, and went the other way and said, you know, this actually seems more like what Western religions talk about as meeting God.
Right. Yeah. Well, there was that experiment in the, you know, at Harvard
and
church. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say he I think his about the
you're cutting out
law and. Oh, sorry. How's that? Any better?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, yeah. His most recent book is about the Kabbalah and prophecy or something like that.
No, it's about the visions in the Hebrew Bible.
Yes.
So right. The ecstatic visions where people would suddenly find themselves essentially pulled out of their body, talking to God, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. He said that these things are very similar to DMT experiences and are likely
endogenous.
Thank you. Yeah. Endogenous, not androgynous.
I like androgynous DMT.
It can be that too. Yeah.
Those machine man.
His take on it was that was what was happening in the Old Testament, is people were having these spontaneous DMT experiences and attributing it, understandably, to visions of God.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, go ahead. The problem with that is there's yet to be any evidence that our brains are flooded with DMT. Or, you know, there's this whole folk mythology now that DMT, you know, whenever something weird happens, that it's because of endogenous DMT. And unfortunately, there's no real data to back that up, that there's ever... that the DMT in our systems is ever concentrated to a point where we have, you know, some kind of vision like that. So that's my gripe with that. The same as when people say, oh, you know, near death experiences are simply DMT release in the brain. I'm like, you know, if you've ever had a DMT experience, it is absolutely the weirdest, most bizarre thing. It is nothing at all like near what people report the phenomenology of near death experiences, period. Yeah. Nothing like it at all.
I think it's individualized too. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, individualized, but at the same sense, from what I've heard about from people, the DMT experience has a loss of ego that a lot of, not all, obviously, but a lot of near death experiences don't have.
It's just astoundingly strange. It's nothing like the clarity that people report with a near-death experience. The phenomenology is completely, absolutely different. So it makes absolutely no sense that someone would link it. If you've ever had a DMT experience and someone tells you about their near-death experience, say, no, hell, that's nothing like it. There weren't these crazy geometric chrysanthemums with little, you know, robots with glass, with 100 glass eyes rolling out of it.
Right.
And
right.
surrounding me and poking me with needles. It's right, it's exactly. it's so different.
Yeah. No, and
well,
it's,
what I
go ahead.
What I wonder when it comes to like spontaneous DMT releases in the body is if they could be caused environmentally. So like, you know, we know that we have things like earthquake lights. You know, pressure builds up in the earth. They seem to release these things that are mistaken as UFOs that are just earthquake lights or earth lights or whatever. What if that same pressure, that same thing that's causing the earthquake lights has an effect on us that releases DMT into our system? So then someone's standing there, they see a light, and at the same time they're having a DMT release into their system and then have an entire experience that because they're now opened up to that frequency and the light becomes a part of it.
My problem with that is psychopharmacological, and because if you ingest an amount of DMT that becomes psychoactive, it is incredibly weird and bizarre. There's not like a threshold dose that someone can give you where you might just see a light floating around.
No,
it's,
what I'm saying
it's either,
is
yeah, it's either, but that's the thing. When DMT is in your circulating in your system, crossing the blood brain barrier in your brain, it's incredibly yeah. weird. It's just weird. Terrence McKenna said, if you can be astonished to death by this stuff. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Soraya.
What I'm saying is not that they're seeing the light because of a DMT release. They're seeing a light that's actually there. And the same energy that is creating the light is also affecting us on a physical level. And maybe it won't be DMT, but something else that causes us to enter an altered state.
Sure. Yeah, but absolutely.
The Persinger idea.
I think what Michael's getting at is either you're in Victorian England or you're down the rabbit hole. You don't see the white rabbit running through Victorian England to the rabbit
right.
hole.
Oh, yeah, right? Sure.
Yeah. Which,
but look how weird UFO experiences are.
Yeah, is that is that because you're running into some sort of strange field of electromagnetic noise, or is it because there's some external thing that is visiting us that has something that appears to be a structured craft, or is it some, you know, combination of that, or do they, you know, whatever it is, throw electromagnetic noise at you that makes you think that there, or you know, who knows?
And just what I was saying, I think what he's saying is that, like, you are in reality, you see something. An external object or light that imposes something upon you, where in you experience you do go down the rabbit hole, and then once you're in the quote unquote in the craft, to use you know popular ufological terms, then you are down the rabbit hole. But there's you know there's perhaps that that threshold in between of something like actually influencing you to be transported to that altered state. I think that the DMT thing is a lot. That's the frustrating thing, right? It's a lot more useful of an explanation or an incorporation for things like the abduction experience versus things like structured craft sightings or landed craft sightings, because they have landed craft sightings and structured craft sightings have enough of the mundane world around them that you're obviously not in a completely fully altered state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My gripe is not with the idea that an energy can trigger something in our bodies that could change our perception. It's the focus on DMT itself.
Right.
Because the phenomenology of DMT is just it is just absolutely bizarre, indescribably weird. And it doesn't have the same sort of qualities that even someone being taken on board a craft in a typical abduction, the craft is not swarming with multicolored shapes and lights and things like that. And that's what you get when you have DMT at a psychoactive level in your body. Well, now, something along the lines of ketamine, if there's a ketamine analog, that's a little more close, I think. And people have hypothesized a ketamine-like antagonist as a possibility for near-death experiences. I think that's a little more worthwhile of investigation. But DMT, because people see entities on DMT, it's a convenient it's a convenient lens to look at all these other experiences, and it's probably very useful for that reason. But the substance itself, whether it's an ayahuasca or smoked DMT, is not going to generate the classic taken aboard a structured craft, probed and poked and and lowered back down to your body.
Well, I think the idea is that, at least the idea I like to, even when I first read Strassman's first book, The Spirit Molecule, that it is like and can inform, not that it is, because that's a correlation causation thing that I think we shouldn't step in that.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's a good analog to try and figure something out, like looking at like astrology. You know, I don't think stars affect how we do things. What I do think is that there are patterns in the universe that correspond with patterns in how people live their lives, and that sometimes they match up because, you know, the human psyche is fairly well. It goes along certain pathways, so. You've got two patterns that match each other occasionally, and that's what I think is going on with the DMT or, you know, ayahuasca or whatever you want, that and connecting it to the UFO or anomalous experience.
Mm-hmm. You know, also possibly that whatever intelligence can use the DMT state to present itself.
Yeah.
The same intelligence that could show up as a specter or a craft in the sky. And it makes absolutely perfect sense that if it appeared through a very psychedelic, bizarre state, that it's going to look psychedelic and bizarre. But that doesn't mean it's not the same. It's not the same thing. Poking its head there where it can poke its head in other ways.
Yeah.
Into our reality.
Right. Oh, great. Those are coming out on the emoticon. I mean, the messages come out through the audio. Oh well, that's all right.
yeah,
exactly. Oh, there's your sirens.
Nice.
There you go. Even though I don't
like I told you guys, I live in Baltimore, so when I don't hear sirens is when I start to worry.
Yeah, you get wonder what the hell's going on. What happened? What?
Right.
Right. It's
why
like,
aren't there any sirens?
Yeah, like
are all the police dead?
Yeah. or that my cousin.
It's the Carrington event.
Like the that scene in My Cousin Vinny where he's in the hotel and he can't sleep because there's no noise and he gets thrown in jail and everybody there's a riot going on and he sleeps fine because he lives in New York.
What a great movie. Utes.
Utes. Yeah. What exactly is a Ute? Yeah. do you guys want to keep going? I know Michael wants to go watch the ongoing ALDS, right?
I have to watch the Orioles who I just took a peek. They are now 2-1 against Toronto for the American League divisional wild card.
Ah, what inning?
So it is in the bottom of the fourth.
Yeah, so. All kinds of stuff can happen.
Still got some time.
Yeah.
If, you know, I want to say, guys, this has been a fantastic conversation. And Greg, thank you for hosting. Thank you for having me on board. This is the kind of stuff I could talk about till I'm blue in the face.
Yeah, me too. And we could go for 5 hours. Yeah.
Yeah, and I can't think of a better crew than the crew that you've got here. Well,
and I would like to pitch a Michael Hughes Radio Misterioso one-on-one because I would love to hear that.
Okay, we'll set it up.
Gordon White.
Yeah,
Mike and Radio
Misterioso. One-on-one, yes, okay.
Anytime. And I wanted to also say that I am doing a keynote talk for a tarot convention in Florida on Saturday. So if you guys don't hear from me again, I have an unfortunate feeling that I might be spending a lot of time in airports Friday morning.
Where is the talk?
It's in Palm.
Where's the talk, Mike?
Palm Beach Gardens. It's near where the PGA is played or something. I've never been to that.
Okay, I think my sister-in-law is there. So if you really get stranded, you can always bunk with them.
does she have a beard? Does she have a beard like you? Because that's how I would recognize her.
No.
Oh, okay, never mind.
Very much not.
I hope this isn't my last podcast appearance ever. I'm knocking on wood that that's not the case, but it's really been awesome, Greg. Thank you. I loved the last conversation we had on Where the Road Go. I was really looking forward to this. I'm glad we managed to all get together in one time in one cyberspace.
Yes.
And man, let's please do it again. I would also like to say, if anybody's listening and they're doing that kind of contact work that we're talking about, trying to make this stuff happen, let us know. I really would love to engage with more people on that topic, because I've been thinking about it for years. And I really do think that's where ufology needs to go, is let's make these guys show up.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Then let's ask them what the hell they're here for.
If we can.
And hope they don't just laugh at us.
Right. Yeah, if we can. I don't know if it'll be a question and answer thing. I think it'll be more like, geez, what just happened there? And then about 2 or 3 weeks later, or a year later, you go, oh, I see what happened there. It'll be delayed.
Right.
Delayed.
Or we'll all be in straitjackets.
Yes, exactly.
For trying, but hell, might as well try. All right, guys. Well, great conversation. Thank you so much. And I look forward to our next discussion.
All right, Mike. I will contact you about being on the show, and we'll explore other things.
Fantastic. Awesome.
Thank you.
Yes.
All right.
Okay, guys. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye, Mike.
Take care.
So
I love it when people from different parts of my life get together. It's so nice.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you bugged us to get together. I mean, it was the last time I don't even know how was I on Where Did the Road Go? Did somebody just say, Greg, can you come on at the last minute? I can't remember.
We were talking about Tom DeLonge.
Yeah. Oh, and, that was it. Yeah.
Mike actually wanted to do a show on it, and I said, well, if we're going to do a show on it, we should bring Greg on.
Right, yeah. I wonder if DeLonge, well, he probably didn't even listen to it, but I wonder, you know, if... Because I said certain things on Coast to Coast when I was on, and Knapp asked me about it. I just said he better watch it, that he's not being used, and that and he goes, no, he doesn't think that. It's like, well, of course he doesn't think that. You know, but privately he better...
If he thought that, he would be keeping his mouth shut about it.
Yeah. So, exactly. If you know, I said, I think it's exciting what's going on with him, but that... he should really take everything with a huge grain of salt and step back from it and be non-emotionally attached if possible, which is, I think, the answer to a lot of this stuff, or at least an attitude, a lot of it before. So you don't either sound like a nut, annoy everybody else, or become an asshole, is just by keeping yourself a little bit emotionally detached from it. Well, it's probably good for everything, but especially this junk.
Yes. And it is good for everything, because people get very, very emotional about stuff and then they stop thinking rationally or clearly. They just get so devoted to what they want to believe.
Yeah. Well, that's how you get, you know, that's how the loudest person in the room controls the room, because everybody just wants to calm them down and everybody's in this panic mode. So what gets you out of the panic mode is calming down the crazy person. And the crazy person invariably knows exactly what they're doing.
Yeah, the social fetal position.
Yes. That's right. You mentioned that before. Yeah. Yeah, Josh. So, yeah.
That's a nice way of describing it.
Yeah. So that's, you know, I think that an ego thing is really, really important to pound down and have not be part of the conversation in the mix when you're talking about doing research or opining on weird stuff, because it's really easy to form it into something where you're the important person.
It's a matter of learning how to self-check.
Yeah.
You know, and realize, why am I thinking this? And just kind of knock all those original beliefs back down and see if they still stand back up on their own.
Yeah, exactly. Which is really hard to do.
For me,
you cut out.
The thing that I'm doing right now is... Oh, sorry. What? Hey, hi. Hello? Hello?
There you are.
Hi.
Okay, for me, Soraya's like, hi, what are you talking about? For me, the more difficult thing is
questioning yourself to no end and finding someone who articulates a lot of things that you want to have articulated and then not just going with it or whatever they say. That's what, sort of what I'm going through right now. I think Soraya's probably keen on what I'm getting at. Yeah. But have you ever encountered something like that, Greg, where like you've been so – you've had such a sense of agnosticism for so long and someone comes along and articulates that but also like – steps up the game in terms of being like, not only should you not believe the status quo, but this is what I believe, and this is what, not necessarily what you should believe, but look at how parsimonious my worldview is. Like, have you ever encountered that and like tried to wrestle with that and wrestle that away? Because I don't want to be that person, but I feel myself slipping into that, and it terrifies me.
Oh, I do it all the time. I got to watch it with, you know, I got to watch it with with Valet probably. Because I try to be critical about some of the things that he says, but I think what it is just I'm excited by the things I'm excited by, and the other stuff if it's not exciting to me, I just ignore it. That's my check, I guess. I don't go, whoa, that's bullshit. I just go, well, that's not important.
I think that one of the warning signs is anytime you find yourself agreeing 100% with somebody, there's probably something wrong with what's going on. Because everyone has a different view of reality. And you're never going to agree with someone 100% unless you're just being a psychophant.
Yeah.
And I always find that funny with politics, is someone might say, you know, oh, well, I agree completely with this person. And it's like, really? Well, completely?
Well, and I think what it is really is coming back to my personal experience.
Please
find someone who has explained the broad strokes. So, again, with such efficiency that you tend to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Sure.
Yeah, I think I heard most of that. Yeah, well, the thing is, you can agree with everything somebody says, but the thing is, you haven't heard everything they've ever said. You could say, I agree with everything you're saying right now, or everything you've said that I've heard. You know, eventually, if you go and hang out with them, you might find something you don't agree with, which is fine.
Right.
But the thing is, you know, I don't really worry about agreeing with somebody totally. If I agree with them totally, that's fine. Maybe I can talk and we can get some work done and find out where we don't agree. And maybe the point of disagreement might be something that I have to examine. But if we don't find anything we disagree with on, then we just go ahead. Yeah, because if I agree with somebody that much, I want to talk to them personally, which is partly why I have a show.
right. Yeah,
because I want to find out where we might not agree, and you know, I don't specifically make questions to be antagonistic about somebody, but in the course of conversation, I might have some disagreement. Ren Collier was on my show a couple weeks ago. I haven't posted it yet, and we got to a point where he said that everybody can do anything, and I said I don't think so. That's simplifying it, but he said that with enough work and thought and everything, anybody can do pretty much anything they want to do. And I said, I don't think that's true.
And no, it's not.
And it's not being elitist. It's not being an asshole. It's not being, you know, whatever you want to call it. It's just like, some people can't do certain things.
I mean, there's a lot of
things I can't do. So I just don't attempt. So, well, if you attempted them, you could. It's like, I might, but I'd be really, really frustrated and I'd suck at it.
You look at high level, high functioning musicians, and there are some musicians who are like the two or three people in the world who can do this one thing. But even more specific than that, like contortionists who are born with certain, certain double jointed aspects. Yeah, they can't.
I think he was talking about mental things where like, you
intellectually.
Know,
yeah. No, and I got that.
But, and I know for myself, there's certain things that I can't figure out no matter how hard I think, you know. I can read somebody's book, you know, a book by a brilliant scientist 100 times, but I'm not going to understand it, no matter how hard I try, because I just don't have the background and I don't think I have the intellectual wherewithal to get my mind around certain concepts.
Our brains all work a little bit differently. That's why some people can look at a math problem and have it solved in a split second, whereas other people are going, what's going on here? Yeah. And it's not a matter of one person being smart and the other person being stupid. It's a matter of our brains function at different levels and they function at different things. I would say that there's probably, no matter how bad someone seems at stuff, there's probably something that everyone is really good at. And if they can't name that thing, it's probably just because they haven't found it.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, no, no. Well, and this ties literally into the exact question that I was going to ask, which is, I remember getting into journalism school, and one of the professors saying that everyone is an expert in something.
Yeah.
And my first knee-jerk reaction was like, no, there are some people who just sit around and don't care about anything, and they just follow popular culture, and they're not an expert in anything. But then, like, you've got to take a step back and say, well, they're probably an expert in some sort of niche of that popular culture that I'm not, you know?
Or they're an expert in something they've never applied themselves to because they're so just caught up in popular culture.
Right. Like, I've talked to
them. Yeah, but they can't do anything. They can do the thing that they're good at that they haven't found out yet.
Right. And right. I mean,
yeah.
If you apply yourself to something, even if you suck at it, eventually you'll at least become average at it.
Exactly.
You work hard enough, but you're never going to be brilliant at it. You know, I mean, some people have a knack for photography, and you can sit there and you can learn photography all you want. But if you don't have that eye for it, you're never going to be a great photographer. You may be a quality, solid, average photographer, but you're never going to be a great photographer because it's not your knack.
Yeah, it's art versus craft, right? And it reminds me of sometimes every now and then I have conversations with my musician friends who are like, you know, I wonder if there's something that I'm really good at that's super mundane. Like, I'm like the world champion, cherry stem tire with my tongue. Like, there's something like
insurance adjuster or something
completely non-applicable. Yeah, exactly. I do think there's something in everyone that's like, you know, you could be naturally good at this, but yeah, interesting.
Okay, we've been almost an hour and a half. Do you guys want to keep going, or do you need to? I probably need to go and make dinner.
I'm fine either way.
Okay,
I'm fine either way too.
Yeah, the thing is that I want to post this almost immediately, and unfortunately, almost ahead of Josh's interview. Sorry.
That's fine.
I noticed that Tim put up something on Coast to Coast for Brimstone Deceit, which is wonderful. I hope.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, he reached out today, and we had a brief conversation about it, and I'm very happy with some of the feedback I'm getting.
Okay, good.
Great.
Even though some of it is about farts.
Oh, yeah, that was bound to happen. You know? it's Facebook comments and YouTube comments are the reason that we can't have nice things, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was gonna turn to farts eventually.
Yeah. You know? I think the internet is why we can't have nice things.
I'd agree with that. No, but thank you for the mention, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Sorry,
I did have a poltergeist last time I talked to Joshua.
Please, what happened?
There's some truth in that. Yeah.
There's one step more that you didn't know about, Josh, that I found out afterwards.
Oh no.
So it started off about an hour before we were going to do our interview on Friday, and I walked out through our entranceway, which is kind of a mix of like bookshelves and entranceway stuff and a cupboard. And there's this heavy metal tomato grinder, cast iron thing, sitting on a high shelf. And it just fell off the shelf. There was no possible way it could have done it. The floor doesn't shake when you walk through there or anything. And it just slammed into the floor. And I was like, well, what is that? You know, like, how did that even happen? A moment later, the stereo in my room that was set to satellite radio and muted suddenly started cranking AC/DC at a very high volume. And so I stopped and I went, didn't I mute that? And I went back in, and sure enough, the door was shut. When I opened the door, I'm like, oh my God, that's loud. And I went over and I turned it down and I muted it again. And then I walked out of the room and I didn't get past the entranceway before it unmuted itself again.
Yeah.
So I came back and I muted it again and it stayed muted. And then I started talking to Josh, and without touching anything, my microphone turned itself off. So suddenly Josh starts going, are you there? And I'm going, yeah, I'm still here. Why are you? And he can't hear me. So I take the microphone out of its sleeve to turn it off and turn it back on again. And it's the switch is in the off position.
Huh.
A little while later, we go to talk with everyone where we did our demonic roundtable.
Right.
Same thing happens. The switch just turns itself off.
Physically off.
Physically off. Yes. And it's under a plastic piece. So I can't even if I wanted to, I couldn't accidentally hit it.
Why doesn't all this exciting shit happen to me?
And because you want it to happen here.
Yeah.
And this was the topper of the whole thing. The next day, I have a small CD case that I take to the radio, to the Last Exit for the Lost with me, with some current stuff that I really like. And it takes full sized jewel cases and stuff. And it has been sitting there. I hardly ever touch it during the week. And it's sitting there next to a cabinet behind me. And I pick it up and I start to walk, and CDs go everywhere because it's unzipped. And it literally would have been impossible for me to put it down there unzipped, because all the CDs would have fallen out. So it literally was unzipped on the floor, and I didn't notice until the next day when I picked it up.
Like I said, I wish, and none of this weird stuff happens to me. I feel so cheated. Maybe I should do shows on demonic possession.
Maybe. It would have made more sense with that if it happened after the show on demonic possession, but instead it happened before.
But it was preloaded, you know? You were preloading everything, you know? Expectation and whatnot.
Yeah. Well, thank you both.
That was interesting.
Go ahead. If we want to keep going a little bit, that's fine. I was going to say thank you both for being on the show. It was, I talked about all the stuff I wanted to talk about, and I probably talked too much. So I thank you for that.
No, it's a pleasure as always, Greg.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been way too long. It's been like 48 hours. So.
All right, you guys, I will talk to you both soon. And since Josh was on the other day, it's Soraya's turn to pick the outro music. And I'll just look it up on YouTube.
Sure. Play some One Eyed Doll.
Okay. Never heard of him.
Hang on. Let me give you a song. Let's see what you can find easily on.
Well, we've got Committed, Live, Be My Friend, Nudie Bar, Witches.
Nudie Bar!
No. Oh. Do Be My Friend.
Okay.
Either that or Envy. Those are the two. Envy is a very dark, moody song, and Be My Friend is very funny.
I think,
but in a dark, demented way.
Okay, well, maybe I'll stick with funny. The dark, demented so funny is right up my alley, so.
There you go.
All right, you guys. Thanks so much. I think I can play this well. Nah, it might not let you hear it well. No, there it is. Well, I'll turn it on. You can't hear that at all.
No.
Okay. You'll hear it when I post it. So what I'll do is I will equalize this and probably post it tonight, since it's called a pop up, and I want to stick to my pop up rules. So,
all right.
Okay. I'll talk to you both very soon. And thanks so much again. And this was a hell of a conversation. And, if we keep talking like this and doing stuff in the background and telling people and cheerleading, stuff's going to happen and we're going to hear about it. I just know it. So thanks.
Let's hope.
Yeah.
Thanks, Greg.
Pop up Mysterioso. Good evening, everybody.
All right. See you guys.
Bye.
Take care.
Bye.
There's a girl across the street from me. I buried her son beneath that tree. I don't know why she's mad at me. He was stinking up my garage, you see. I met a cute boy. He liked my smile. We fell in love for a while.
desire.